Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Extent of his social life.
It's the Taryn Show.
The Taryn Show.
Don't ask if he's single, you already know.
Cause it's the Taryn Show.
A simple name
for a simple guy with a simple face.
It's the Taryn
Show. Hello everyone and welcome to the Taryn Show. We are back and I've got a great guest for you. I think this is going to be somebody that anybody who has watched the UK version of The Circle or has been watching the US version of The Circle and listening to the podcasts and seen this guy, you should be very excited because I have the great Tim Wilson on to talk to right now. How are you doing, Tim?
I'm doing really well. Thank you very much.
Very excited to have you on. Very excited to talk to you. You seem like you have lived a very full life and you're going to have a lot of great stories to tell us.
Well, I hope so. Who knows? It's about pressing the right button. That's your job. And my job is to respond with some sort of strangeness. to poke my head back into the past and try and find out what is relevant, what is not relevant. Maybe say something slightly inappropriate, but we try really hard to keep it sort of on track.
It's not too often that I get guests that aren't American in general. I've had a few guests that sort of moved to the U.S. as a kid. And so there's a sort of story there. I certainly talked to Freddie as well from The Circle, and that was a lot of fun. You probably have a whole ton of experience in a country and a history that I probably don't even know about.
Oh, well, it's originally yours, after all, you know.
It's true.
And
a little further back, though.
But there's a great theory that the language of Shakespeare, that Shakespeare would have spoken very much in an American-sounding way, that you preserved a lot of the language that he would have used. You preserve, you preserve speech rhythms and particular vowel sounds, which we've lost because we had all that sort of Victorian nonsense about sort of stiff upper lip and trying not to open your mouth when you speak.
It's interesting.
It's all because of dreadful teeth on this side of the Atlantic.
Well, I feel like, I don't know, because I know that it's sort of the general consensus, or at least it feels that way in America, that British accents are kind of cooler than American accents. I don't know. I kind of feel that way. I kind of feel like there's more of a flow to a British accent. And I know there are very many variations of British accents.
Many variations of American accents, which
it's true.
I just didn't realize until I went over there briefly. And I was amazed, even in New York, the sort of great variety. So it's such a joy hearing Joey. It seems to be a different accent from street to street. You know, and I think at one point, certainly during the during the early 20th century, you could have said the same thing in London. You can't anymore. That's where the play Pygmalion, which then becomes My Fair Lady, comes from. That Professor Henry Higgins could identify which street somebody comes from. And now I don't think you could. So you got sort of estuary English, which has taken over, which is a sort of English that Tony Blair embraced when he wanted to be sort of one of the gang, and that's about it, really. Otherwise, you've got that sort of triangle of what used to be called RP or BBC English or the Queen's English, which is pretty well what I speak. But I do it by default because I spent about 10 years in Greece. Constantly making recordings, a little bit like you, but I was doing English as a foreign language, and it just sort of cleaned up my language. I was saying listen and repeat, and then after sort of 10 hours in a recording booth, I'd start getting giggles, and that was catastrophic, really.
Well, do you feel like that the British accent has been, are you saying that it's sort of like coming all meshing together into like it's sort of being more generalized? Because I think that something, my sort of understanding of it is that, you know, Great Britain or whatever you call the whole island, right? It's a very small place in comparison to the U.S., but there are still so many different cultures and variants and accents involved. So
we've got a great range of regional accents. As you go out of London, you can get this wonderful wealth of accents, and particularly as you go up into the north of the country, and you get these amazing Scottish accents. For example. Robin Williams, when he was doing Mrs. Doubtfire, he effectively based his accent for Mrs. Doubtfire on the accent that what's the name of the lady who did Professor McGonagall? Wonderful actress, Maggie Smith. The accent that Maggie Smith adopted when she won an Oscar for a film called The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, and she adopted a Morningside Scottish accent, which is a sort of posh Edinburgh accent, and she would say things like, my girls are all broody girls, and I'm in my prime. And she had a great line in that film where one of the girls was nasty to her, and she's, assassin, you're an assassin. And she based this on somebody that she knew, and she rang this lady up, and she said, I gather you have a wonderful Scottish accent. The lady said, Scottish accent? I just speak English in a normal way. and you can hear it. If you listen to Robin Williams, he's taken that accent and then slightly sort of morphed it. So when he does it, oh, no, dear, it is, in fact, Maggie Smith, understood by Robin Williams. And it's a sort of lighter version of the Morningside accent that Maggie Smith was doing in The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie. And I find that sort of analysis so exciting. And I find the diversity of language, and the fact that people have got different rhythms and different accents and they say different things. And this is why I find the whole discussion about acronyms and sort of the speech which we're using now and the whole thing like rap. I love the idea of rap. I've not understood enough about British rap or American rap. I've got into Russian rap, which is very, very exciting. I just think, you know, because rap has a huge history. You can take it back certainly to the 1920s, and there was a lady called Edith Sitwell who wrote nonsense poetry, and it was set to music by a man called William Walton. And there's a great collection called Facade. And you stand in front of an orchestra. I've done it. And you stand in front of an orchestra with a megaphone, and you recite this sort of rubbish which has no meaning, with the orchestra playing away madly behind you. And that really is, I think, one of the earliest examples of modern rap. But then you can take it back a little bit further to Gilbert and Sullivan, the patter songs, and that's also there. But what you're looking at rap is how you take just simple language and make it musical. And you have it again beautifully done in The Lerner and Lowe, My Fair Lady, and Henry Higgins. So rap has been with us for many years. It's not a new thing. It's just been a new life. And to go back and to find ways to give new life to things which we just do routinely, that seems to me that that's what our life is all about. We want to constantly rediscover what other generations have been doing so well anyway, but we want to rediscover it for ourselves.
Have you always been interested in language?
I have a mouth, in a
more academic sense, or maybe you're just interested in everything in an academic sense, including language.
I don't think of myself as an academic. I think of myself as an entertainer. Okay. If you'd ever come to any of my lectures, particularly the ones where I've not sent myself to sleep, I have sent myself to sleep in my own lecture. I think, I've told you this. Have I told you this?
I don't think so.
Well, it was in Russian. I was a university professor in Moscow, and every so often the university people think that you need sort of schmoozing, and they take you off for a sort of rather boozy lunch. And on this occasion, they took me off to a Siberian restaurant. Look, I've got a cat here. But they took me off to a rather boozy restaurant for a boozy lunch, and they gave me a plate of what turned out to be a bear. It was disgusting, really. And I felt like I was eating through sort of one of the Disney characters, nibbling through Baloo. And to drown it, I had rather a lot of vodka. And I went back into my lecture room, and there were sort of 300 students sitting in front of me in sort of serried ranks. And I tended to lecture without notes because I thought that was rather grander. And I found it was a slightly boring lecture. I don't remember exactly what it was on, but it would have been some sort of philosophy thing. And I found the voice of the lecturer got slower and slower. And then, thank God, it stopped. And when I raised my head from my chest and looked up, I realized I'd been asleep. I'd sent myself to sleep because I was lecturing sitting down. And, and I looked up and all these eyes were looking down at me. And they were terribly polite. None of them said, "Oh, sir, you've been asleep." I had no idea how long I'd been asleep. And there comes a point when you get to a certain age, or past 50, when sadly you realize you don't sleep in complete silence. You sort of make noises, not always from the top part. And I thought, oh my God, what sort of noises have I been making? How long have I been asleep? And they must have just thought I was having some academic moment. But so after that, I always lectured standing up and with notes. I don't have any notes here, so if I start to go to sleep, please tell me. Darren,
well, I podcast standing up, presumably to keep myself from falling asleep.
Awake. I have no idea why I'm telling you this story, but I love entertainment, and I love the idea that even if you're lecturing, even if you're doing something academic, you're really telling stories. And that's what you want to do. You want to tell a good story, get somebody's interest, maybe throw in the occasional bit of a fact. I remember my lecturer, my tutor in Oxford. I went to him and I said, "Oh, I'm going off to tutor or to lecture somewhere. And do you have any advice?" And he said, "Oh yes, well, there's only one piece of advice that I can give you. Now, when you are lecturing, always tell people what they know. They like to hear that." And I thought that was very good advice. So now I try and make sure I don't tell people too much that's new. And I go back over things that they know, and they all look so happy and reassured.
What you talked about being an entertainer, though, it reminds me, and the conversation about language also a little bit reminds me of a writer that I really like, Ted Chiang, who wrote the a story of Story of Your Life,
yes,
which was adapted into the movie Arrival, and he writes a bunch of short stories like that. And what I love about him is that he takes these really cool ideas. So Story About Your Life was an idea about language and how that can influence the way that you actually think. And he turns those ideas into entertainment, into stories. And he kind of in a way, sort of teaches and makes you think about things in a new way via an entertaining story. And I love that. Yeah. It's so interesting to me. He released a new book of short stories called Exhalation last year that I loved. And in one of the stories, he talks about more about language and in particular, like writing and how, with the invention of writing, essentially, there's a theory, at least, that shifted the way that our brains works, that, you know, you organize your thoughts with writing. And so we shifted from an oral culture to a written culture and
far less repetition.
Yes. That was so interesting to me because I'd never thought of it that way. And the idea that well, of course, written culture is better because we can record things and we know the truth, but we're very biased because we are living, like, that's how our brains work. And the idea that there's a lot of value to an oral culture, was something that never crossed my mind. And through this, like, very short but entertaining and interesting story, I sort of broadened my mind into the idea of, like, just like how the act of writing something down can literally change the way that your brain works.
Utterly. A very interesting test is if you write something out while you're podcasting and you read that and then you use the same idea and you just say it without reading, you'll find you're actually doing something different. And when you listen to it, the spoken stuff without reading is better than the stuff that you read. That's number one. So it's much fresher. The oral stuff is always fresher. The second thing is the oral stuff often isn't syntactical. So I notice you use the word like quite a lot.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't use that if you were writing.
Yeah.
That would be excised. I use the word quite a lot, which is apparently, is it I think it is which is very rude in Turkish. It's incredibly rude. I think it's I can ask in a few minutes, but you see, I can't stop it.
It's, yeah.
But I wouldn't use that if I were writing, and I probably wouldn't use it. I seem to have unplugged myself. I probably wouldn't use it if I were reading what I'd written. But it's got a sort of vitality, that hesitation, and then you've got the repetition because we're always repeating ourselves.
Yes.
It's fascinating when you start looking. One of the Odyssey and the Iliad, we know that these come from an oral tradition because there's so much repetition. You've constantly got the rosy fingered dawn turning up in the Iliad, and there's no reason for that except that would be one of these sort of tropes that starts a particular recitation.
So, yeah.
And you can find these things in sort of all the old texts, like the Gilgamesh epic, the Enuma Elish, the Bible, and you have rhythms. My Arabic's not terribly good now, but there's lines of Arabic poetry which you get in the Quran or in some of the more secular poetry, and you can suddenly hear wonderful sounds. It's so onomatopoeic. You get it at the beginning of the Bible in Hebrew, which with the Spirit of God hovering over the waters. It's Ruach Adonai, and it sounds like breath, but you wouldn't have that if you were just writing it.
Yeah.
You've got these wonderful rhythms that you get when you just speak.
And it makes me, you talk about repetition, as somebody that is a big fan of the show Big Brother, where there are live feeds, right? Where you get to watch these people for 100 days play a game, and they're not allowed to write. And you see, this is essentially like a mini oral culture, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you see them constantly repeating, like, I think that we don't realize how often we repeat ourselves in everyday conversation, when even just in a single conversation, in a single sentence, we repeat ourselves. Yeah. I'm repeating myself right now.
But each time you repeat yourself, you do it in a different way. So you're actually communicating something slightly different.
Yeah. And it's also how, you know, we often talk about on a show like Big Brother that perception is reality, and that that, like, you know, truth or anything like that, it's harder to, like, distinctly ascertain, because there's no record that they can see. We can see it. We can go back and be like, this person's wrong because this is exactly what happened. But to them, yeah, that doesn't matter. The stories that they tell are entirely based on the need that they have in that moment.
Absolutely.
Right. And that's super interesting to me. And that's one of the reasons why I like reality TV, because I think that there are so many different interesting things that you can glean from it and learn from it and analyze in it beyond sort of how I think a lot of people view it, which is just like entertaining trash.
Yeah, trash is never entertaining. You know, there are people, if you go to good lawyers, they're rooting around through waste bins. Trash is full of nuggets of brilliance. You should never dismiss what is ephemeral. Our life is made up of the ephemeral, of the passing. That's what's most important to us. But I think again, if you look at a sort of legal thing, we really look to have someone like Ali here, who I think is a lawyer, isn't she?
Yes.
Yeah. But she would say, So if I were to say something, so XYZ now, XYZ, sorry, we're speaking to an American audience, XYZ. If I were to say XYZ now, and then in a few minutes I say ABC about the same thing, what are you going to say? You're going to say, oh, but you said XYZ 5 minutes ago. Now you're correcting it to ABC. Which one is true? It's not necessarily the case that the first thing I said is true and the second thing is an embellishment. Sometimes things which are much later may actually be much truer. We shouldn't confuse antiquity with authenticity. Simply because something is old doesn't mean that it's necessarily better. I'm probably doing myself out of a job here, aren't I?
No, that's great. It's so interesting to me that I was, you know, I just feel like we don't often think to look at these things, reality shows, whatever, in these terms ways.
Look, to Taran, I so much want to write the book about the idea of reality TV, partly because I've never seen any. I mean, you know, I haven't seen Big Brother. I think I've chanced across one or two episodes or bits of episodes. I've seen so little. I was so excited by The Circle. I was so excited by watching the first 18 hours of the first episode, the first series of British series before I went in, and then being actually within it. So my first experience really of reality TV was being on it.
That's definitely an experience.
And then when I came out, I was sort of thinking, well, reality TV has got this huge history. I could trace it back, I think, to a show in the early 1960s run by a man called Bruce Forsyth, who was full of catchphrases. But you probably have got precursors to that. In American TV, it's the moment you take people out of the audience, put them on live TV, and give them a game to do. And I'm sure that was being done in the States first. And that is reality TV. But there was a program on British TV which went on for about 25 or 30 years called The Good Old Days, where we dressed people up in Victorian costume and got them to sit in a theatre and watch variety, which we would have called music hall. And the turns, a bit like X Factor, the turns weren't great. Some of them were good, but some of them really were pretty awful. And the stars of the show were the audience, and people just wanted to dress up in Victorian costume and sit in the audience and ooh and ah. And that, again, is reality TV, because reality TV seems to me to be about saying to an audience, hey, you could be involved in the show, and look at these people here. These people are you. This is you.
Yeah.
And so you have that immediate rapport with the television viewing audience, because they see themselves on screen.
Yeah, and that's again one of the things I love about it is that, you know, I think it takes a very talented writer to create a character that has the depth of an actual human. Like I have an issue with that, where when I'm reading books or I'm watching shows or movies or anything like that, characters are really important to me, and I think it's so easy to get it wrong and to just create like a very shallow sort of blank slate of a character that is there for the sake of the plot,
or not shallow enough. That's the point. You find very often in sitcoms and in soaps, people are constantly giving you plot points rather than actually being characters. And most of the time when we're talking as characters, we come up with such a lot of rubbish. and that rubbish gives you an insight into the way we're thinking. That's a vision of our soul. Yeah. And I think, I think it would be wrong to say that reality TV is unscripted. It is scripted, but at a distance. So somebody has set up an environment where these things will take place naturally. And if you surrender to that environment, my goodness, the magic happens almost like that. And it's simply spectacular. And watching the US production of The Circle, I can see the magic taking place. And it's all down to the great Tim Harkett, who invented The Circle. And so having been part of it and then seeing it taking place, I can see the magic. I can see, how he's found a way to literally turn the ordinary idea of drama on its head. So he's taken a detective story and he's shown the viewing audience the end. He's shown the viewing audience all the answers. And the people who don't have the answers are the people in the game.
Yeah.
And it's like sort of deconstructing a detective storyline.
Yeah,
it's beautiful from both sides, from the side of being a participant and from the side of somebody watching. And I find it captivating, actually.
I like what you said about essentially like the scripting in these shows is taking real people and putting them into situations where you get a desired result, maybe not always exactly what you're looking for, but one of my favorite writers is Robin Hobb, and she talks a lot about her characters as being people outside of themselves. She can't control them. She just puts them in a certain environment, and then she lets them, in her imagination, run amok.
Dickens did the same,
right?
Dickens,
yeah,
and the amount of times you look at when writers actually get the opportunity to talk about their craft, they say that the characters take over the story.
And that's very reality TV.
It is reality TV. If Shakespeare were alive, I'm sure he would be sort of participating in some form in Big Brother.
Because
that is Shakespeare, isn't it? That's real life. And the other thing I find fascinating about looking at the American Circle, and I didn't have time to really sort of sit down and understand it or analyze it when I was looking at the British Circle of the first series. But I will go back and have a look at it. Is everybody speaks at a different rhythm. And you've got the wonderful Joey, and he speaks. He's got this incredibly plosive way of speaking.
Yeah.
I mean, if this were Dickens, he would then be illustrated in a very specific way, and he'd be very different to Mercedes, and he'd be very different to Sammy, and of course, Rebecca Seaburn has sort of progressively got this lighter voice. So he's become terribly feminine. And he moves in a very feminine way now, and I think in one of the episodes, I think he was doing a bit of twerking or something. it's just delicious the way character takes people over and the way character gives us a story.
Yeah, and I think that'll even happen from a viewer perspective as well. If you're watching a show like this, especially a show like Big Brother, for people who do watch the live feeds and they're like engrossed in these people's lives every single day, they tend to sort of mimic mannerisms, ways of speaking. And they do it in the house as well, where they all start to get certain catchphrases together and they all start to say the same phrases, and, you know, have a sort of, you know, in-house lingo. And it creates its own culture in that way.
Yeah. And also, I mean, I love the way how people start giving each other nicknames and sobriquets. I mean, in the American version of The Circle, you've got Shuby, mm-hmm. who I think was named by Joey. And I don't know whether we did anything like that in my version. Oh, I do remember people calling me Timmy. I'm never really sure about the name Timmy. I think the name Timmy is the sort of name you give to a dog. but it's also quite affectionate.
Yeah.
But I do feel that when you give somebody a nickname, you sort of own them. It's like having a pet, isn't it? You know, you name your goldfish.
That's interesting.
Shuby, come on, Shuby. Do you think
maybe it's different if somebody gives themselves a nickname and tells other people to say that?
Yes, sometimes that doesn't really work, does it?
Yeah. Well, I think that sort of putting a nickname onto somebody, I think is in a way sort of like I am putting my own twist on you.
As a teacher, it was always a mark of great achievement to discover that you got a nickname. And I found when I went into schools, I would often get a nickname quite quickly. The last school I went into, the headmaster came along to me and told me that they were calling me Prof Santa, which I thought was quite nice. But the best school story I've got recently is a little boy. I was looking after the what would you call it? High school. You call it high school. Mm-hmm. And it was quite a wild high school. And I was just doing sort of temporary stuff. And I went in one day and a little boy came up to me and he said to me, sir, what sort of car do you drive? And I said, well, I don't drive a car. I don't know how to drive. He said, oh, that's right. You go by sleigh. I just thought that was so clever. He couldn't have planned this at all. And how could I be angry with that? I couldn't be. If I'd had an opportunity to give him some sort of marks, I would have given him a sort of top grade for that.
Wouldn't that be great if you know, making jokes about your teacher gave you better grades?
I think and what students don't realize is the teachers do imitations of the students in the staff room much the way that imitation of the teachers outside.
I would imagine.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so tell me more about yourself. How did you get to be where you are now? What was Tim like as a child?
It's all by accident. I went back to my old school, and I was taught by priests and monks, and one of them came up. I was asked to give out prizes, and one of them came up to me and very slightly pompously actually said to me, oh, he was always a professor when he was at school. Well, I don't think I was really.
Yeah.
Certainly I wasn't acknowledged as such. And I don't think I was treated as a great intellect. And I certainly don't think I am. I was always a bit quiet. It didn't mean I wasn't naughty. I just got away with it. I wasn't a great games person. We were made to play rugby, and I thought that was a very cruel and undignified sport. And we had to do it in the snow and the rain. And I remember if the ball came anywhere near me, that was the point when I put down my copy of Lord of the Rings, or I stuffed it into my shorts and ran like hell in the other direction. and I've still got my copy of Lord of the Rings, and it's got its price on it, which is sort of 15 shillings or something, old money, which proves its age. And I used to take this book down onto the games field and read.
You said you were taught by monks, and how does that work? Was that just the school that you went to? Was it a particular kind of school?
Yeah, it was a school I went to. When I was 7 or 8, I was sent to a boarding school. We would call it a prep school. Now, in America, a prep school is something much grander that you go to, I think, to prepare for college.
Would something that be right? Like that, I think.
Yeah. In Britain, a prep school is what you send very small children to prepare for what we call a public school, which, of course, mm-hmm. isn't public at all. It's private. So you've got all this nonsense going on. Yes, I was sent to a Catholic boarding school, and it was very Spartan. I seem to recall rows of beds in the dormitory with snow on the bottom of the beds because one of the windows didn't close properly. We were very cold. I also remember we started off with straw mattresses, and there was a great day when we got proper mattresses, and we had to change them all. I have these memories from when I must have been about 7 or 8 years old, and you think now this is a very brutal way to deal with small children. I don't think I would want to do that.
Yeah, in my imagination, sort of like what I've seen on movies and television, a sort of, you know, British boarding school back then was probably like they were very strict, and maybe they like hit you with rulers or I don't know.
Well, it wasn't rulers, and there was a person in my school whose only job was to beat little boys, and I think that was deeply brutal. So this was Hogwarts with brutality. I sort of survived. I was never actually beaten. I think I was the only boy in the school who was never beaten, but I did cry a lot.
Yeah.
I remember crying over Latin a lot, because the Latin teacher was phenomenally unpleasant and terrifying. And he was only about sort of 3 feet high. He was like a leprechaun, but a vicious, vicious leprechaun. And we had to, he would give us something to learn the night before. And if we hadn't learned it and we couldn't recite it the following day, children would be sent off to be beaten. And I remember on one occasion, I'd been in the infirmary. I'd been ill. And I was let out after a week of being in bed. I was let out just in time for the Latin class. And I came down and all these boys were reciting a thing, is ea id, this or that. And we went down the rows of desks, and in the process of, I think, two rows, I learnt most of the recitation. But then suddenly three boys in front of me couldn't recite it, and they were each sent off to be beaten. And it came to me, and I struggled through the first half, and then I had to stop because I hadn't heard any more. And I was threatened with being beaten, and I was called out to the front, bring a piece of paper, and you write on this piece of paper, you know, how many times you're going to be beaten, and you're supposed to take this off to the discipline master. It was deeply brutal. And some little boy at the front of the class says, but sir, he's been in the infirmary. Well, why didn't you tell me this? And of course I burst into tears, and it was horrible. I was crying most of the day.
It sounds absolutely awful. Like, I can't imagine, what is it like to live with that every day as a child? Like, is there any semblance of a sort of normal school experience that you can, or at least a modern school experience where there, you know, you still have friends and you have fun with things? Like, is it even that must be looming over you constantly?
Well, my only experience of a normal school is as a teacher. And, you know, when I see a child who looks miserable, I just want to go and try and make them look happy, try and make them happy and find out what the matter is. The other day I went to the theatre, and you know, now sometimes in the theatre you've got these sort of airport security things. And I was waiting for Freddie, actually. I was going to see a show with Freddie, and we sort of all red carpet stuff. And so there are all these people from reality TV. I think somebody was trying to suggest I should go on a show called Dancing on Ice. And I said, well, if I've never been on ice without falling over, and I'd scream. Doesn't that make great TV? There you are. I went to this airport security thing and the entrance, and there were two little children who came through, and one of them must have been about two, and she was wearing this amazing costume, and her little brother was there as well. He must have been about five, and she was looking terribly sad, and I got down on my knees and I said, what's the matter? Are you looking forward to the show? And she sort of broke a little smile. She cracked a smile, and then her brother wanted to get in on it. And then this lady came up behind them, and she was terribly famous. And I felt so embarrassed. I'd sort of taken over her grandchildren. And so we sort of got introduced, but it was, I find it awful. thinking that a child is sort of nervous or anxious, and I think that's the effect. I find it really difficult sort of seeing children looking miserable. I find it difficult seeing anybody looking miserable, actually.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a good quality to have as a professor.
Yeah. I think I'm more, that's the point. I think I'm more interested in communicating with people than I am in processing lots of sort of erudite information. I think I can do it sometimes. Most of the time I can keep a bit of information in my head. But I'm more interested in finding out, oh, who are you? What have you been doing? Where are you from? What's it like living in Boston? You live in Boston, don't you?
I do, yeah.
Yeah, it's so exciting. You've got three universities in Boston.
Lots of colleges. I don't know. What's the difference between a university and college?
Oh, university is just a grand British word for a college, isn't it, really?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of colleges here.
You've got Boston University, haven't you? You've got Princeton. And
BU, Harvard, MIT.
MIT as well, though. I didn't know that. No. Boston is the place to go, isn't it?
I think it's one of, like, the busiest school towns, cities in the country, I imagine.
Yeah. Now, I was brought up in a little town in Lincolnshire in Britain called Spalding, and 10 miles away from that was the coast, and the little town on the coast was called Boston, and it's one of the places where the Pilgrim Fathers set off from. And your place is named after your place is named after the place I used to live near.
A lot of our, especially East Coast, locations are stolen from.
Yeah, yeah. Well, improved. Let's call it improving.
Yeah.
You're redefining, doing it better.
Yes. Yep. Yeah. Well, so, okay. So you're going through this brutal boarding school.
Yeah.
What is your goal when you're a kid? Is it just to avoid being beaten? Is it to
avoid
grow
being
up
beaten
and get out of here?
It's really strange. What's that syndrome? I think I quite liked my captors in the end.
Stockholm syndrome.
Stockholm syndrome. I think I had a bit of Stockholm syndrome because I quite enjoyed being at school and sort of but it was brutal. And what did I want to be? I really wanted to be an animator. And when I was 11, there was this wonderful there was a little television program, and there was I think there was a Sunday TV show, half an hour long, of A Christmas Carol. It would be 1972 or 71. And I thought it was spectacular. It actually won an Oscar for that year. And I looked up who had made it, and I wrote to them. It was a Canadian man who was living and working in the UK. And he wrote back to me and invited me to the studio. So I got togged up in my school uniform, and I went down to London for the first time to Soho Square. And I went to see this man, and I went around his studio, and I was so excited. I vomited on the way there, on the train on the way. I vomited the moment I got out of his studio afterwards.
Oh my God.
I don't think there was really any vomit left by the time I got home in the evening. But I saw how these things were done, and I'd always loved the Disney thing. And I remember also seeing very early manga, very early anime. There was a film called the story of Hans Christian Andersen, which was an early anime film which had made it into the cinemas at about the same time. And I just thought there was a world there. I wanted to see how that worked, and I always wanted to move. I wanted pictures to move, and I didn't really care whether they looked like Mickey Mouse or whether they looked like Leonardo da Vinci. I just thought everything really tends towards movement. And so I was doing my own little animated films on paper, and I had no way of filming them. I was just drawing, and I was drawing movement, and I loved comic strip, and I loved the idea of taking stories that I knew or taking sort of boring bits of chemistry or something, a periodic table, and turning that into a comic strip. Drawing my teachers down the side of my exercise books and getting into trouble for that, or drawing on my desk. I was a fastidious drawer, and I remember I had great difficulty with my art teacher, who was really quite nasty to me, and he used to rip my work up in front of the class, and he would say, "Now I want you to draw the child who is sitting opposite you, Wilson, what are you doing?" "Well, I'm drawing the child who's sitting opposite me, sir." "Yes. I haven't told you to start." "No, I finished, actually." and take it. I was like, "I don't want something slick like this and rip it up and throw it away." And I thought maybe there isn't a future in drawing. So maybe I have to look at the church. And so I then thought maybe I need to become a monk or a priest. And we had so many religions in my family anyway. I thought one more isn't going to do that much harm. So I had these two things, but I think I was only looking at the church because I hadn't really discovered theatre.
Yeah. Well, it was, you were in a religious school. So is that, do you think school, where?
No, it was inevitable. And my three things were art, sort of academia and theatre. Church seemed to express that rather well. When I eventually got to that point, I was a dreadful monk. I was constantly escaping to the local synagogue, and to the local mosque, and the local Anglican church. I still am very interested in different forms of religion and people who have no religion. I think all manner of belief is fascinating. It's an inner life, you see. It's about the way our minds are working, and maybe religion is sort of metaphor for that. It's a way of dramatizing our inner thinking. It's a way of dramatizing our thinking.
Yeah. So when did you make the decision that you felt like, okay, I'm gonna go be a monk? And was it, did you think it came from a place of worship, of faith, or
No, it came from a place of, it came from a place of desperation. I thought other things are not working. And I'd gone to one university, and then I really wanted to go to Oxford, and for one or two reasons I hadn't done. And I applied to Oxford. I called up, a college in Oxford. They accepted me. And then the master died without having written all the paperwork. So it had all been in his head. And the acting master then had an interview with me, and it looked as if I would have to do the exams again. And I thought, oh my goodness. And my mother was very disappointed. She thought I was going to become a dropout. But what am I going to do now? I would go away and become a monk. And so it's a moment of desperation. I think other people might have had suicidal tendencies. I had monastic tendencies. I was really bad, and I got thrown out because I then did the Oxford exams. I got offered a place, and I didn't say anything. And then at the end of the following year, I said, "Oh, I'm about to go off to Oxford," and they were furious with me. I just assumed they knew, but I assumed they could just see into my mind. They couldn't.
So you went to be a monk, and then you left after,
yeah,
to go to Oxford.
Go to Oxford, and I loved Oxford. I was in Oxford at a time when there was a wonderful British television program called Brideshead Revisited, an adaptation of the book by Evelyn Waugh. And so everybody was walking around the place with sort of pullovers sort of rolled up on their shirt, on the back of their shoulders, and walking around with teddy bears. Well, I had a teddy bear, and more than that, I had a white rabbit. I used to walk down the street. So I think I fitted in rather well, actually, to this sort of mad, eccentric sort of revival of the 1920s. I think, who was it now? Byron used to have a bear. Oscar Wilde had a lobster that he walked, and Tim Wilson had a white rabbit. And on one dreadful occasion, my rabbit got away.
Oh, man.
And met other rabbits. And when I got him back, about a month later, he suddenly gave birth. So he was quite a magical rabbit. And I was quite convinced he was a boy, but he did give birth.
Yeah.
to quite a lot of baby rabbits. So I had to change his name. And the rabbit lived in my fireplace. I had a wonderful Inglenook fireplace. You have to imagine a sort of cold winter's night in a sort of in Boston with an Inglenook fireplace. You know, it's like Sleepy Hollow, and around the fireplace there was a sort of fender. And as the rabbit grew, I had to find ways of propping the fender up, otherwise the rabbit would leap out of the fireplace and into the rest of the room and then start nibbling the furniture, as rabbits do. And I thought, what can I do? But I got all these copies of Thomas Aquinas's book, The Summa Theologia, and so I put volumes of this, because it ran to many volumes, under the fender and lifted the fender up, and during the night I'd hear the rabbit reading Thomas Aquinas. sort of ripping out of the pages and romping through serious adventurous theology adventurously.
I want to know more about being a monk, the time as a monk.
Well, the time as a monk sort of passes monking. Monking was
what kind of monk were you?
Well, I belonged to a strange Italian religious order. So ultimately, it aspired to be contemplative. It aspired to be a silent order, but actually, quite a lot of noise was made. And I was the person who used to do most of the cooking of breakfast and things. And I remember that I would look down from my podium where I had to read about people who died. And so during breakfast, we would read the martyrology. And so I'd be reading about people who were squashed under heavy doors and then were stretched by horses. And it's a perfect thing to be having breakfast to. And there'd be some one old man sitting down who I'd just made him his eggs. And he would say, "My egg's not cooked properly. Did the boy cook the egg?" And I'd be saying, "And Margaret Clitheroe was stretched between four horses." And and you'd have these completely irrelevant comments. I found ways of staying in bed until the last possible minute in the morning. The monk costume, that black sort of onesie, really, that black costume covers everything. So you can still wear your pajamas underneath it and get an extra half an hour in bed when everybody else is sort of running around the place pretending to have tea and coffee and bleary eyed. I thought, no, the trick is to stay in bed for that half an hour, enjoy the bed, and then leap into this black onesie, rush down to the church and start singing and pretend that you've been up for half an hour. And I found that works very well with everything, even in the circle. I wake up like that, bang, and I'm away. And no one could believe I'd do that. Open the eyes, off we go. And that I learned in the monastery. I learned many things. I learned how to breathe in the monastery. If you're feeling really, really stressed, just breathe. And, there's a lot of religious stuff and sort of, theories of meditation behind that. There's one thing called the Jesus prayer, but essentially it comes down to just breathing, and breathing is terribly important. And you can put great theory around that. The word, inspiration. Is a Latin word, inspiro, which simply means to breathe in. So if you control your breathing, you're going to be more relaxed. You're going to be able to do things, and you can't do anything if you don't breathe. You're just going to stop. That's it. So you need to be in control of these things. I learned that, and I learned how to sort of meet deadlines, I think, sort of. And then after I got out of the monastery and I was in Oxford, and I never had enough money, so I did a lot of artwork, and I was always trying to meet a deadline, writing essays very quickly or doing posters or illustrations for people, or learning lines for a play. I mean, that's a great one, because you can't turn up halfway through the third act of Hamlet, and so to be or not to be, that is the question. Whether it is noble, sorry, I haven't learnt anymore. That's where I stopped. You can't. The audience has paid its money. You have to complete the job.
Yeah,
and that's a great thing to learn early on in life. You got to do the job.
Was there ever an inclination that you felt like that you would stay as a monk? That you would ever?
I would love to have stayed as a monk. Mm-hmm. I felt so secure. But no, they threw me out. They threw me out for an act of gross disobedience for applying to Oxford without permission.
Yeah.
And out I went. Boom, there's the door. You can go tomorrow, or you can agree to go to Cambridge next year and stay, or you can go to Oxford. You can leave immediately. And I was out of the door within 20 minutes.
Wow. Was that a painful experience to be kicked out like that?
It seemed pretty brutal. My life ended. It seemed pretty brutal. I got over it. I did a bit of breathing. I struggled with my suitcase for about 15 miles, I think. I don't think I had a car, and I don't know how to drive anyway. So I sort of lumbered on. You just make do. You deal with life.
Yeah.
You must have had these experiences too.
Probably, but very different actual circumstances, but probably similar feelings.
Yeah, I remember when I was caught in Greece, and I suddenly found I didn't have any way to get back to the UK, and I had no money. And some old man said, "Hey, Sonny, would you like to look after my goats?" And I said, "Oh, great!" I mean, I thought, I could look after two or three goats. I had 100 goats up a mountainside, and they gave me a house with no doors and expect me to sleep across the doorway to stop the goats getting out. I had a wonderful time, really. When I think back on it, it was blissful and bucolic. Great word. But it was actually very smelly and really rather terrifying. And I simply didn't know what was going to happen next. A little passage of time colors one's experience.
Yeah. Well, I imagine that, I mean, this is a lot of experience to accumulate when you're so young. Like, was there a lot of, especially like being a monk, like did that afford you an opportunity to do a lot of self-reflection and grow?
Oh, God, or? No. There was no self-reflection. I mean, do I look like a man who's done much self-reflection? No, for goodness sake. No, introspection. I don't know. Now I'm doing self-reflection, aren't I? I don't know. I suppose a certain amount of self-reflection is inbuilt, but there's not much to think about. No, nothing happens in a monastery, really. Mm-hmm. And certainly nothing happens in a private way, because you don't go out anywhere. You don't have experiences beyond the confines of the monastery. It's a little bit like being a small child. Mm-hmm. Small children don't really have anything to tell their mother, because their mother is sort of party to everything that they do. And then suddenly they go away to school, and the small child comes back and has got these stories about a life that their mother has no access to in school. And this becomes quite thrilling, but also quite sort of difficult, I think. And parents suddenly see their children disappearing.
Mm-hmm.
They say, "Oh, why is my teenager rebelled? Why is my teenager no longer the lovely little girl that she was when she was when she was three?" Well, because she's got different experiences, and she's bringing those experiences to you, and you have to adjust to that. So life is all about adjusting, I think. Gosh, that's very deep. I'm so sorry.
That's what we're here for. So you have eventually went to university.
Yeah, yeah. I went to a number of universities, but Oxford really was number two, and then I did some stuff in London University, and I did some teacher training as well, but not until I'd been teaching for a while.
So how did you go from wanting to potentially be an animator, artist, but also, I guess, interested in academia to a degree, to, okay, going to go be a monk for a year. All right, now back in school.
Well, I continued everything. I've never let anything drop, really. So I continued my interest in theology and sort of the business of monking. That's my academic discipline, really. I do a bit of philosophy as well, but essentially my academic. Oh, look, I've literally got the cat sitting next to me now. Isn't that sweet? I always did some teaching simply to get money.
Mm-hmm.
And I was drawing all the time, literally all the time. I've never stopped that. And wherever I could get a job doing a bit of animation, I did. So I've always managed sort of two or three jobs at any one time, and I've never stopped doing that. Even now, I think I'm still juggling a little bit.
Yeah.
The only time when I've seriously only ever done one job for a period of time, I think actually was while I was in the circle.
Yeah.
And even then I was, they allowed me to take some books in with me, and I took in a copy of Little Dorrit. My God, that's boring. It's one of Charles Dickens' really off days. I mean, it takes such a long time to get into that book. And I've been meaning to read it for years, and I thought, now is the time I'll get through it. And it was really is not a page turner. And it is eventually, but you have to get into it. Now, the Dickens book I really like is a book called Dombey and Son, which isn't about a son at all. It's such a misnomer as a title. But I also took some music scores in. I took some opera scores in. I took a copy of Gilbert and Sullivan's Trial by Jury, and I took a copy of Figaro, and I think that was it. And I read the scores, and I was sort of doing work. I was sort of imagining what would it be like to animate Trial by Jury or to animate Figaro, and could we have traditional 2D Disney style animated opera? So that was the little private life I had while I was in the circle.
Have you gone anywhere with that?
Oh God, yes! I've got the whole thing storyboarded. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But I remember at some point, I can't remember whether it was just before I went in, somebody said, "Oh, you can't take in any music." And I said, well, "I can take in the score." And they looked at me very, very oddly, and I think, I can hear it in my head. I follow these little notes; they go up and down, and you can sort of hear it, and that's quite exciting. I find that. Oh, that's fun. I can't always sing it accurately, but I can hear it.
Yeah.
That's interesting. You do, yeah.
I hadn't thought about that as a way, like, around having, like, not being able to listen to it. I wouldn't be able to hear a score, like, instrumentally,
I don't think I can hear it instrumentally, but I can see where the notes are going. And sometimes you look at, particularly with a full orchestral score, you look at what the violins are doing, and the violins are doing, my God, the violins do this amazing thing here. And nobody picks that up because they're following a piano score. Mm-hmm. And suddenly you've got this amazing thing which is being done here. And you think, well, I could do something visually on that.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah.
And look at this. Yeah. And the tune here moves from one group of voices to another group of voices. Couldn't we do something visually to indicate that that's happening? And it would be sort of subliminal, because an audience wouldn't pick up all the detail, but I would know it was there, and it would sort of fit.
Yeah, it's an interesting way to look at it, because I started sort of my professional career as an editor, a video editor.
Perfect.
And music was always super important to me in terms of editing.
Because it gives you rhythm.
Right. And it's so important. Like, rhythm is the most important thing, in my opinion, at least when it comes to editing. Music is a great way to link with an edit. And I'd never thought of actually digging into, like, the score of a piece of music because
there are other rhythms in there.
Yeah.
And other sort of runs of instruments. But particularly when you're looking at sort of Victorian music where it's really very detailed. Mm-hmm. And it's so beautiful. And when you're editing a film, you know, you edit often on a movement, don't you?
Yeah.
You edit it so somebody's moving, and then you do your cut, and you sort of hide that. You don't need to do too much of a fade from one thing to another, because you've hidden it in a musical moment.
It's always been very, very sort of just based on, like, instinct. Like, it's just sort of because I think the reason why I was, if I can call myself a good editor, the reason why I was able to do anything with editing, I think, was because I grew up just constantly watching things. And so the first time I ever edited anything, I just instinctually knew this is where we're doing the cut. And it worked. I feel like I didn't do any work to make that happen other than spend my life watching things.
Yeah. And you know, today in the 21st century, we're dominated by this sort of visual culture of film. Mm-hmm. And so much of it, I think, was, I think there's three great films that define the medium of film. There's Battleship Potemkin, which gives us the basic tricks of editing. Then I think you have to wait quite a long time until Mary Poppins. And Mary Poppins suddenly gives you the ability to put one world entirely and believably in another. And then I think you need to go a little bit further to 1982. Oh, I can't remember. Roger Rabbit, anyway.
Okay.
87. And Roger Rabbit, suddenly you've got that sort of finesse. And from that, you get things like Star Wars, and well, you've already got Star Wars, but you get the development of the big cinema spectacular, which still dominates our screens today, where we're moved into a world that cannot possibly exist. And also, you know, people like Tarantino seem to me to be inspired very much by the Hollywood musical, as much as by westerns and by the war movie genre, but that takes us back to this idea of ephemera, because the Hollywood musical is something in a way you just sort of throw it away, but it's so much work goes into it, and it's sort of frivolous, but it's hard work being frivolous. It's hard work being funny. It's hard work being just sort of entertaining.
Yeah. Did you ever teach any classes on film?
I've done film theory a little bit. I've done animation classes, particularly in Russia, where there's a great fascination, great love of animation and the technique of it all, and how do you do it? How do you tell a story? Mm-hmm. Can you tell? I mean, you know, if you're interested in editing, you come down to the question of what is film? Is film about dialogue? No, really, it's about telling a story visually and through the edit.
Yeah.
So you can almost take all the words away. I find it fascinating watching films in languages I don't understand. And you often find you've got someone who's very enthusiastic and wants to translate for you. Oh, for God's sake, shut up. you know, because if the film is any good, it's still going to communicate whether you've got subtitles or not.
Yeah.
You're still going to, that language is visual, and the dialogue is an extra.
That's why I loved editing it. It felt to me like it always felt to me like the most powerful role in the creative process.
Because it is powerful.
Yeah, and I feel like people don't always see that, because, you know, and sometimes
if it's done really well, it's like it's like espionage. You've done it without being seen. You know, you are the James Bond of the film world. Mm-hmm.
And there are very like powerful creative visionaries that will often like very tightly storyboard their films and give a lot of direction to the editor. But that was never, you know, I didn't work on films like that. So I always had a very strong sort of creative power.
Even if you're storyboarding, there's still quite a lot of scope for the editor. And that storyboarding thing, that is Disney, by the way.
Yes.
You know, so again, you go back to your Mary Poppins, and you go back to your Disney canon, and again, you're looking at at an art form which you could say, oh my gosh, this is just being thrown away for children, but it defines the medium, and now it rules Hollywood. and with good reason. With good reason.
You know, they don't really make bad things.
Well, how can you? When you've got that wealth of knowledge and wealth of experience, and a pool of talent, it seems to me to be very difficult to get it monumentally wrong. Of course, occasionally people do, but
Yeah, well, I feel it's interesting. I feel like at that level, the grading scale shifts, right? Where I think they've failed if they've made something that's average.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. But of course, you can't. The other thing is you can't always be changing the format. You can't always be defining the format with everything you do. A lot of the things you do, you just have to reconcile yourself to the fact that you're going to follow a formula that works. One of the things I think is so wonderful is, you know, the big action films like Indiana Jones. Nothing is really redefined there. It's just it's following that formula incredibly well.
Yeah.
And when you break that, then you start to have difficulty with sort of, the Bond franchise is another really good example of something that keeps redefining itself, but essentially it's following a formula that works. And when you break that, it's very difficult to come back and do something and sort of redefine something. So the film of Cats, I felt sort of slightly missed it.
Yeah, I did not see that one.
Yeah, I don't think you should really. but Mary Poppins Returns, I thought was a very, very good effort to follow the formula almost to the beat. But it would have been so nice if the main characters had really been able to sing. I mean, they were great, and the Hamilton guy is just so winsome and gorgeous. I mean, he needs a film on his own right. Well, I think he's directing one anyway. So, no, he's a major star. But where are we going now?
Wherever you want. Tell me what you talked a lot about. Being in Russia.
Oh, yeah, that's an accident as well.
How did that happen?
I found myself teaching. In a funny school in Oxford, and increasingly it was taking on Russian students, and some of them asked me if I would go over to Russia and do some teaching in the holidays, and I was only too happy to do that. Fascinating country. I remember the first time going over there, and the snow was sort of almost up to my head, and it was very cold. And I stood on a bridge, an iron bridge, opposite the Kremlin, and I drew the Kremlin, and I thought my hands were going to drop off. Then I got introduced to various people, and somebody asked me if I would if I would give some lectures in one of the universities, and I was very flattered, and I went along. And the next thing I knew, I was offered a job, and I don't think it ever really paid. But I was very devoted to my students, and I had a wonderful master's class, which went on for a few years, where I was we were looking at the difference between teaching and learning. So if you're teaching, really, you're trapped behind a desk. Shut up, write, and do this. That's what you do when you're being taught. But when you're learning, you feel you want to be liberated from the desk. You want to stand up and say, look, I've learned something, and sort of move around. And so the furniture of a university, the furniture of a school needs to be changed if we're going to be encouraging learning rather than teaching.
I'm very interested in, I think that as a professor, the idea that you have lived an interesting life and you've done a bunch of different things and you've gone to different cultures, I think that's so important because that helps, I think, obviously you understand the sort of context of the knowledge, but I imagine it also helps you sort of convey that.
Well, no, it's odd because what's strange about this talk, I don't know how this is going to communicate to your audience, is it seems to me to be a very slightly heavy, and I do apologize.
Oh, it's sometimes these get way heavier.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, right. Okay. Because I find when I was doing the circle, all the sort of theory disappeared, and what you got was light bounciness. But the theory underpins that the thought is genuinely going on inside the head. And for about 10 years, I was involved in directing opera, and I found a lot of the time it was sort of so much better for me to pretend to be completely ignorant, because the MD, the musician, the conductor, was always so much better about the musical performance than I ever would be. So I didn't want to interfere with that. And I found all I had to do was set up an environment where the story could take place. And because I was designing as well as directing, I could move my scenery around. I could redesign the scenery if I had a particularly difficult soprano or tenor. Sopranos can be terribly difficult. And you know, oh, I only ever sing from down here. Okay, we'll do that. But then you know, if you sat quietly for long enough, they would actually get to the point that you were looking for. And you didn't necessarily know. One doesn't necessarily know what is right, because it's not right. It's not what's right for me or what's right for the story, but it's what's right for that particular performer. Because there's no point saying this is the way to do it if that performer can't do it. But that performer can find that character within themselves if you give them that right stimulus. And that isn't about giving them lots of theory. You have to have the theory, but sometimes you need to shut your mouth and let the moment develop. And you never know quite when that's going to happen. I did have some disastrous moments. I mean, there was one occasion. Am I allowed to tell this story?
I don't know.
It's slightly rude.
Go for it.
All right. Okay. There was one occasion when I only had a chorus. I think I had a chorus audition. I had a chorus rehearsal for. I only had two sessions with them. I think so. It was two 3 hour sessions. That was it. And I knew that I wanted the chorus to do a little dance, and my choreographer hadn't turned up. And I thought, oh God, what am I going to do? Because I have no sense of, I have every sense of movement, but I'm not very good with the movement myself. So I thought, okay, I'm just going to have to choreograph this myself. And I got into a habit of sitting on a chair, a little wooden chair in the rehearsal studio. And it was a pretty rickety old chair. And it had nails sticking up all over it, and it was, and I remember on this occasion I got up from the chair, and as I got up there was a sort of ripping sound, and then I turned around and I did my little dance for them, and so they were looking at me from behind, and they all followed the movement, and then I sat down, and as I sat down I put my hands behind me because I wanted to avoid the nails. And I realized my intense horror that what I could actually feel was flesh. And it wasn't that there'd been a slight rip in the trousers, pants, you would say, but actually the underwear had also ripped.
Oh.
And a complete square of clothing had detached itself. And I was, I think the polite term is I was mooning at the entire chorus. And it was one of those occasions when, again, rather like falling asleep in my own lecture, nobody actually said anything.
Yeah.
The problem was when I had to get up and demonstrate the next movement, and I thankfully had a coat on the back of my chair, and I sort of slid that over my shoulders. I must look like some sort of strange spy. But auditions, you know, having people coming in, you knew the moment when they walked through the door if you wanted them. And so when they sang, it was just a matter of sort of checking whether or not they had the notes. But there'd be some people who come along and they couldn't sing. And there would be a point, you've seen 100 people and you're a little bit giggly anyway. You think, is there any way that I can actually stuff this handkerchief in my mouth? How do I stop my shoulders going up and down? And it doesn't matter how self-controlled you are. After 100 people, you're just giggly, and it's dreadful. And I felt so. And these people mean well, but do they have no? And that's what Simon Cowell is all about, really. And these game shows where people who clearly have no talent think that they're wonderful and no one has told them. And of course they do make riveting television, but I think it's cruel.
Yeah.
Ultimately, I think that's cruel television in the way that I think The Circle wasn't cruel.
Mm-hmm.
I think The Circle, at its heart is an incredibly, benign program.
Yeah.
And it only becomes a little bit cruel when people are playing, have sort of misunderstood the message and they're trying to win at all costs, which I think so there is a point where it becomes cruel, perhaps.
I think probably the cruelest element of it is probably that I do feel like they want people to be duped from the catfishing, because that is entertaining to watch.
Yeah, it's entertaining to watch, but the catfishing is a is is a it was always a misunderstanding of the show. The show is about popularity, mm-hmm. and it really doesn't matter whether you're popular as yourself or as somebody else. If you're going to catfish, then you've got to do it well. I had a sense in the program that I was in, there's a fellow called Sammy, or actually a fellow called James, who pretended to be Sammy. And Sammy had a young boy called Charlie. And when I looked at each of these characters, I drew them. And I had great difficulty drawing Sammy. And I had great difficulty drawing Jay. These are two people who are two catfish. Mm-hmm. Jay I couldn't draw because he wasn't real. And once I'd worked that out, I realized I couldn't draw Sammy either because she wasn't real. And I don't think it was broadcast, but I remember I looked at it and and the first thing I said is mother and child. Well, that's worked for 2,000 years. Every time I tried to draw Sammy and Charlie, what I ended up with was a picture that looked like the Madonna and child. it looked like an icon.
Yeah.
So I wanted Sammy to be the best mother and child possible. Mm-hmm. And I threw myself into that fiction. I was quite happy to go along with that. But James, I think, thought halfway through the show that there was a limit to how much he could talk about Charlie if Charlie didn't exist.
Right.
And he started to sort of become Sammy and to do more about Sammy. And it was a bit disappointing. And I think I slightly irritated him by constantly asking him questions about Charlie.
Yeah. And be like, I see what you're doing, Tim.
Yeah. But it wasn't because I was being spiteful. It was because I wanted him to be the best mother and child that he could be. And when I finally met him, I wasn't that surprised. I've seen some Twitter feeds saying, oh, Tim is so shocked. I wasn't shocked. I just thought that he could have been better. Mm-hmm. And I thought he was channeling himself. He was Charlie. He didn't quite get that.
Yeah.
And Sammy was his mother.
Yeah.
And that's why he understood it so well, because he had experienced that.
It's so interesting to me, the idea of trying to pretend to be somebody else and essentially just watching people fail at it over and over, because I think that it's almost backwards, where I feel like the people with the most amount of empathy are the most capable of lying successfully.
I would love to do it. My first idea was to be a catfish.
Yeah.
And my first idea was to be Mrs. May. I don't think your audience is going to know who Mrs. May is. In fact, in about 5 years' time, no one's going to know who Mrs. May was. Mrs. May was one of our most dreadful prime ministers. She did sort of almost nothing for 3 years. But then before that, she was the Home Secretary, and she sort of messed up visas. And she was a lady who thought bureaucracy was terribly important. And bureaucracy is such a dreadful word anyway. It's a bastard word. It's a mixture of Greek and French, bureau and kratos, rule by the desk. I thought, oh, very exciting to be Mrs. May. So first of all, I went out to try and see if I could find some, is it kitten heels? I couldn't find any in my size. And it seemed a very strange thing to be doing. And then I started thinking, I thought, I've never done any shopping for women's clothes. And I had an afternoon trying to do that and just thinking, I can't imagine Mrs. May doing this. Maybe she does it all through a catalogue. So after a few days, I just thought, there just isn't a lot of room here. So the joke that I could be Mrs. May sitting in the circle, sort of bewailing the fact that I've just destroyed the country, wasn't enough to sustain me over sort of more than a week's sort of circle performance.
Right.
And then who else could I be? And I just thought, hey, better to be me, actually. But, you know, now I'd be interested by the challenge, but it requires acting. It requires understanding another person and then finding that other person, not knowing another person, but finding that other person within yourself. And that's why I think Seaborn is doing so well, because he's finding his inner Rebecca. Mm-hmm. And why Alex did so well, because he found his inner Kate. And actually, really why James did so well, because he did find to some extent his inner Sammy. And so if you can inhabit that character, then you become that character, and that's quite magical to see. And I can't think of any other program that would actually allow you to do that.
Yeah, and it says so much about like identity and the way that we look at ourselves and the way that we look at other people, and of course it's all filtered through social media and that sort of thing.
But I think where people are hiding behind somebody else, then it doesn't work. So Mercedes, Karen, she was hiding behind this Mercedes character who she didn't really get. Mm-hmm. And I think Sean is probably doing the same thing. And there just comes a point where why hide?
Yeah.
And what I'm hiding is the best bit of me. And that's a bit which sort of, it so defines me, and I want to hide that. It seems sort of, so I'm instead of liberating myself, I'm restricting myself.
Yeah. And of course that sort of like relates to the internet as a whole, where you are basically in control of your image. You can completely fake and be somebody else, or you can be you, but a version of you that, that says a certain thing about you. And you know, we get a lot of that about like how things like Facebook or Instagram, can be damaging just to be a part of, because you're only seeing the highlights of other people's lives, and it makes you look at like the non-highlights of your life and like, well, in comparison to that, makes you feel worse about yourself. And that's of course like a cycle, because then you feel like you need to compete. And so you put all of your highlights on, and my highlights are going to be as good as other people's highlights. And there is a lot of things about identity in social media, that I think people, and I think that like, it's all meaningless there, and people think that it will mean something and it will translate to a show like The Circle. And so they go on to The Circle thinking that's how it's going to work. I'm going to show only the best parts, or I'm going to create a highlight reel that's not even me to begin with.
Yep.
But
yep.
At the end of the day, what people respond to is a genuine person, a genuine feeling of something.
I think they also respond to vulnerability. I think
yes.
So the point which I think the point at which I think I came to life was when I was being attacked by Richard Madeley. So I ought to be quite grateful to Richard Madeley for attacking me and my cats. But it was very painful at the time. But what it meant was I was exposed to somebody who was vulnerable. So suddenly one saw the sort of person who was actually quite upset. And I think the same thing with Sammy, James. There were points at which I think when he was being very low and so not knowing whether or not the thing could move forward, that was his vulnerability coming out, and that made him more lovable. And definitely with Alex and Kate, you saw him struggling to portray Kate, and that vulnerability made him more lovable. Woody, in the early programs, I've only seen up to episode 4, by the way, so I'm rather useless. But those early programs, he's struggling to deal with sort of communicating.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember we didn't communicate very early on. And once we did, it was about the sort of time when Ella came in, and suddenly I remember feeling that Woody was blossoming, because he felt he had friends.
Yeah.
But you know, the audience would have warmed to him because of that vulnerability that they saw really very early on. And so I think vulnerability plays, and that's not something generally people are thinking of when they're thinking of hiding behind a fake image.
Yeah, and I feel like a lot of people will sometimes go to an extreme of, like, I feel like sometimes people will try to smother others in their vulnerability in a way. Like here are all of my problems all of the time. And those are the people who are like, will post those sorts of things on social media all the time. But that seems like just a different method of doing the same thing of hiding. You're sort of hiding with all of these things. You're like pushing them all out in front of you. You know what I mean? And so, but I feel like the response to that sort of discourages people from like actually like opening up and displaying vulnerabilities without sort of smothering people in them, because you're worried that by revealing insecurities or vulnerabilities that you are going to somehow turn people off.
I think another example of the vulnerability in the US version was in Joey's wonderful cake making, it wasn't just the cake was such a gorgeous disaster, but he looked as if he'd been through a shipwreck. you just wanted to give him a hug.
Yeah. And he's not, he was like, yeah, you know what? This is me. I suck at this. It's fine.
But in that first episode, you know, where he was putting all the sort of brown stuff on his face and stuff, I thought this man is, you know, he's too sort of in control. Mm-hmm. And to see all that sort of control is still there, but it's sort of, and he's sort of aware that he's, I love Joey, actually. I think Joey is a tremendous character.
Yeah.
And Shubi, of course, Shubi's smile and his desire to throw himself into everything. Again, you just feel such you feel so protective of him, and I'm not quite sure what's going on there. But almost the moment he appeared, you felt protective. Don't you think?
I think so. I mean, I think that it's sort of. I think he kind of has sort of like the little brother role in the game, and just sort of. I think because he is with a bunch of people who are all at the very least pretending to be, if not are, like these like young, like super attractive single people. And then you've got, you know, Shubi, who's a little softer and not into the flirting and not that archetype. He feels very much like the sort of like little brother that just is not meant for that sort of thing. And so we should like make sure that we don't, hurt him in any way. I feel like that's how they feel about it. Don't be mean to Shubi. It's not okay. And I like that. I feel like the circle also exposes some great things about our culture, which is that, people like Shubi and even like Woody, when he was having trouble at first on your season, like maybe the first impression wasn't fantastic, but very quickly people were like, well, that's, we don't want him to be excluded. We don't like that. We want to bring him in. We want people to feel good. And I think that, even though the circle can expose some negative qualities, like a quick rush to judgment and, you know, in-group versus out-group, excluding people, stuff like that. There's also some good in it as well, where, I do feel like, you know, it sort of exposes that, okay, yeah, maybe being attractive helps you on a first impression a little bit, but in the long run, doesn't really matter much on the circle. It doesn't really matter much, you know, who you are or what you do. What matters is that you're genuine and that you're kind, and people will respond to that at the end of the day.
And the other thing Shubi gets, which I'm really impressed by, is that being an influencer is not a very pleasant experience. He immediately got that. I mean, on one occasion, I think I howled with horror when I was made an influencer. But I never expected at any point to be. I always expected to be at the bottom of the ratings.
Yeah.
But I remember on one occasion I was particularly disappointed because I knew that it was going to mean blocking Brooke, and I knew there would be no choice, and it wasn't something I wanted to do. And so you've also got that bit where you're forced to do things which you really don't want to do. And the games are much the same sort of thing. The games push you into a position where you've got to do horrible things. And you've got to say horrible things, and defend it, or, there's so many levels.
What's it like being in the public eye? And, I mean, is this the most exposed that you feel like you've been in terms of the public eye? Or do you feel like you've because you've certainly done public things before?
I've done I've done political things before.
Yeah.
So Shubi and I have some have some parallels. Because we just had a thing called Brexit,
right.
And I could see this thing coming a long time before, but I was worried that it was linked to racism, and I wanted to see whether or not the party that was promoting Brexit really was racist. So I sort of I catfished, and I found myself on the front page of the newspaper and on the BBC, sort of challenging the leader of that party, who still hasn't actually apologized for. What was the most egregious sort of racist comment, not made by him, I must point out, but made by another member of his party against somebody else, not against me. And his argument, Farage's argument, is why is this strange bearded man taking up a fight against me for something which really isn't my fault? And he had good reason to think, well, to be suspicious of me, but it did mean that I was in the public eye for a short period, and that was very, very intense, but quite brief. Mm-hmm. And this has been slightly less intense and over a much longer period. And it's rather lovely walking down the street. I was in Brighton the day before. I went to see Woody, and I think I must have been stopped 20 or 30 times, and I would have thought by now it would have stopped. I would have thought by now that bubble would have burst. But there are times when you just sort of it's lovely. Somebody stops you on the street, or you're filming something, and somebody opens a window and says, "Tim," and it is very sweet. I can actually make this person's day,
yeah.
And that's my job. And the same thing with Instagram. You know, people follow me. I try to go on it and have a look and see if I can follow them, but sometimes their profiles are blank or private, so you can't follow them, you can't look at their pictures. Sort of dum, dum, dum. But when you can. Sometimes you can say things, or you can like a picture, and you can touch them. I would love somebody to have done that to me. So I think here's my opportunity to give something back. And they voted for me.
Yeah.
So, I feel constantly, and sometimes you're feeling sort of a bit down, or you've got a piece of chocolate stuck in your mouth, and somebody comes up to you and you think, oh, swallow quickly, and it brightens up your day too. A little bit of niceness goes a long way in order.
I think it comes back to, you talked about how in a lot of ways you are an entertainer, even as a professor. And was that always an element of, you know, this artistic side of you that was interested in animation and drawing and all these things? Was it always to entertain? Was that a part that was intertwined with that? Like that you liked art for the sake of it?
Absolutely. But I see entertainment in such a broad way. I would see entertainment, and I think Greek tragedy is entertaining.
Yeah,
I think any form of performance, any form of engagement with an audience is entertainment.
And that's what's valuable to you in being able to connect with people by entertaining them.
But I think I'm more interested in the people's response than I am in. Sort of having brilliant things to say. I don't think I've got brilliant things to say, and I'm always very much aware that the things that I say really been culled from books or from somewhere else, and I think, you know, I'm just the mouthpiece for this thing, so I'm more interested in what they've got to say, because their observation or your observation is often much more interesting than mine. I've heard it all before anyway. I know all the rubbish that goes on in my head.
Yeah.
But I don't know what's going on in your head. It's much more exciting, and so I really loved sort of what you were saying about editing, and I think that really is the key to film. And you know, a lot of the great directors really are frustrated editors anyway.
Right. They're just editors who have been forced to go into the real world and edit the production of the actual film, basically.
Yeah.
But I think that's about as much as we can fit into one podcast for now.
We've done a huge amount. I'm so sorry. And please edit me if you think I'm getting too boring.
No,
Do you want me to say some ridiculous things? Do you want to quick fire some ridiculous questions and we'll finish on a high?
Sure.
What ridiculous things can we talk about? Is there anything that you've not asked me that I can tell you about, which will be simply absurd?
It's absurd. I don't know.
What's the most ridiculous thing that you've ever done?
Most ridiculous thing I've ever done. Oh man, I'm not a very ridiculous person, to be honest.
Well, that would mean anything that's ridiculous is going to stand out like a sore thumb, isn't it?
You know what? I've normalized my ridiculousness. The most ridiculous thing I've done is I've spent like 5 years of my life talking about a reality show.
There we are.
Pretty ridiculous.
Which isn't really reality anyway, is it? It's an invented reality. It's a construction. So we call it reality, but it's not reality.
Mm-hmm.
An unreality. It's an Alice in Wonderland world that we're discussing. It's great. Well, do you know all about Edward Lear? You know all Edward Lear's stuff, The Owl and the Pussycat, and
I'm not.
Oh, please say yes. Please say yes. There was an old man with a beard who said, "It is just as I feared. Two larks and a wren, a rook and a hen have all made their nest in my beard." He's pretty well the man who popularized the limerick.
Okay.
In the 1830s, 1840s.
Yeah, I don't know him, but.
Well, he is the ultimate man of the ephemera, of the ephemeral, you know, complete throwaway rubbish, which certainly when I was a child was still part of our childhood. And I still know children who seem to have been brought up on this stuff. The idea of nonsense, which was so much a part of childhood. In fact, I think it still is. You know, it's still there in Harry Potter, isn't it? The idea that you can, that children can live in a world which is not quite sensible.
Mm-hmm.
And then you come out of reading these things or looking at them, looking at SpongeBob and stuff, and you come back into reality with all its rules and frustrations where big people control everything. And then you can go. You can escape into this fantastic world where small people and small animals can be superior and mm-hmm. can twist everything round and make everything so much better.
Yeah.
So idealism and the power of the small and the power of the unimportant. We must never forget it. It's so important. Dr. Doolittle, and that's being remade as a film now. I remember there was a wonderful film made in 1967 with Rex Harrison. You don't know that, do you?
I knew that the Eddie Murphy one was a remake.
Yeah, well, there's now another.
Yes, now there's a Robert Downey Jr. One.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you seen it yet? It's not out yet.
I have not seen it yet.
There's a wonderful song in the original. My friend, the doctor, says the world is made of sugar plums, and who are you or I to disagree? And it's just delightful. Anyway, sorry. Maybe we need to stop on that.
Well, no. I think that's a great message to end on.
And Mary Poppins as well. You know,
this
sort of. Quite strict lady who flies in and magic happens wherever she is and she pretends it's not happening. this is extraordinary. The balance between control and chaos and bedknobs and broomsticks. Disney, you just go back to Disney all the time. But there's a man even more exciting than Disney actually, and that's E.T.A. Hoffman, the fellow who wrote The Nutcracker.
Yeah.
And he's a sort of 18th century, he was an 18th century civil servant in Prussia. And his day job was to invent names for Jewish people. Lots of my friends, when we look at their names, we realize, oh my goodness, your family name actually comes from Prussia and probably was invented by E.T.A. Hoffman. Some of these names are really quite cruel. But you start with a name for grocer or apple merchant or whatever, Applebaum. Rosenbaum and so on. But his secret job was to write these fantastical stories. And he escaped from the humdrum and potentially nasty and potentially anti-Semitic into this world of fantasy.
Mm.
And that idea of escaping, that is film. That is childhood. I think it's also education. I think education is a form of escapism. And editing is about imposing order onto all this chaos.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes. You have to order this this podcast, otherwise people are going to think, what the hell is going on? who is this mad person?
I think people could listen to you talk for hours.
Well, I could listen to you talk for hours. You're going to have to teach me more about editing.
All right, sounds good.
And we haven't talked at all about your film. What's it called? Oh, with the dragons and the pig.
Yes, the Black Cauldron.
The Black Cauldron. Can we have another podcast at some point? We can just discuss Disney films or something. The Black Cauldron sometime.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
On record.
It's Taran the Pig Keeper, but spoilers for the book series, he eventually becomes Taran the High King. So
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Because the film is based on just the first three books, isn't it?
Just the first two, I believe.
All right.
And there's six total.
Yeah, it's not as prolific as The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah.
But The Wizard of Oz is a little bit like Enid Blyton. It sort of sticks to a formula and just keep popping them out. Once you've read one, you've read them all, really.
Are you a big fantasy reader? At all?
My top fantasy person is Ursula K. Le Guin, who's one of your people. She's
yes.
American. She's
yes.
one. She died last year.
Yeah,
great shame. She was spectacular. I love all her work. She made Tolkien sort of accessible, really.
Yeah,
and she took the best of Tolkien, the best of C.S. Lewis, and the best of science fiction. And
what's your favorite of hers?
Probably the Tombs of Atuan. The third one. What's the third one called? The Farthest Shore. It's sort of dark. And in the same way, J.K. Rowling, I'm not a great fan, but I think that Prisoner of Azkaban probably is a great book.
That's my favorite.
There you are. And as for Tolkien, I think the greatest bit of Lord of the Rings is a bit where Frodo and Bilbo are stuck on their own, are going into Mordor. So that's book six, isn't it? Or is it book five? I can't remember. It's one or other of the two king of the Return of the King.
Right.
I think it's book five. And but I used to read all the way through and then go back and read again. And I was quite devoted to it. And then I found Ursula K. Le Guin, and I thought, oh, there are others. I did also discover Michael Moorcock, but I thought he was sort of a bit of a strange being.
Yeah.
I'm betraying my 1970s upbringing, aren't I?
Well, fantasy as a genre has really bloomed lately. That since The Lord of the Rings came out, and then especially now Game of Thrones. Certainly
Game
the television
of Thrones is spectacular, but I think the Game of Thrones, the TV series, is infinitely better than the books.
Interesting. I loved the TV show until a certain point, until they basically ran out of book material to adapt.
Yeah.
And then it felt like it started to lack a bit of depth. There's so much. I'm just constantly reading fantasy.
And the book that I have to pronounce in an American way. Hold on. Let me see if I can. I have to take a breath. Dune.
Yes. How would you pronounce it?
We have a diphthong there. I would say Dune.
Dune. Okay. Dune.
Yeah, it's like June, you see.
Yeah, well, Denis, last name I can't pronounce, great director who made Prisoners and Blade Runner, is about to release these his Dune movie.
But I remember the Lynch film. I loved it. I loved it so much with Sting, and it was so big. And so messed up, and the process work was so bad, but it just had such ambition.
Yes.
And the TV series was good, but nowhere near as ambitious and as beautiful as the Lynch film.
I never watched the TV series, or maybe I did when I was a kid, but I didn't watch all of it.
TV series is well worthwhile. But the books are great, I think.
I actually have not read the books. But I do plan. It's on my list. Right. I have a big list.
We better stop. And I'm going to see you next Thursday.
Next Thursday, yeah.
Yeah. And we'll have a blast with the last few sessions.
Yeah. Well, if people want to be entertained by you, Tim, where can they find you on social media that's not the circle?
Oh, the social media. You find we are on Instagram. Mm-hmm. What is it? Is little at Professor_Tim_Wilson, and then there's a YouTube channel which is Zontal Films Limited, Zontal Films Ltd, all one word, and Zontal is a wonderful Turkish word which means high mountain. It's actually Syriac, so ultimately Aramaic. So the language Jesus would have spoken, he would have said, "Come on, mates, let's go up the Zontal." and have a transfiguration. And then you can also find me actually on Twitter, which I almost never use. I'm going to start using it because I found you on Twitter, Taryn.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. And I'm going to become a Twitter fan again. But on Twitter, you find me under Spalding 3012, Spalding like the tennis balls, I think.
Yes.
Yep. Because I was brought up in Spalding in Lincolnshire in Britain.
Do they make tennis balls there?
They don't make anything there anymore. They used to do a lot of tulips, and now the tulips have died, so I think they're back to producing potatoes. And it's very flat. It's very boring in Spalding, really.
Yeah.
And then there'll be somebody watching from Spalding and say, it's not boring in Spalding. You know, it's got beautiful views of the sky. And you can see for many miles. Farming community, really. I spent a lot of time on farms when I was little.
Yeah.
Farms, horses, cows. I was extremely good at castrating cows. Well, not cows, obviously, bullocks. and piglets. Piglets. I was really very, very good with a knife. From about the age of five. That's horrible. That's horror story stuff, isn't it? We probably should get rid of that. So Spalding 3012.
All right.
And Professor_Tim_Wilson is Instagram. And then YouTube, you can find me under Zontal Films Ltd.
Right.
That's me. And I just go on and on and on, really, don't I?
Okay.
That's awful. Well, I hope I'm not too boring.
No. This has been great. Thank you so much for joining us, Tim. And of course, thank you guys, the listeners, for joining us in this conversation. I hope you enjoyed it. Lots of stuff. Something for everyone in this one. So thank you guys for listening, and I will see you next time.
Bye-bye.
Keep asking questions. Looking deeper, that's what it's all about. It's the Taryn.